Hey, thanks, Glenda and Barbara, for inviting me, and thanks, Maria, for a really excellent presentation about the HEAL study. Today I was going to talk about some work we've been doing in another arsenic-affected area in Inner Mongolia, and I'd first like to call attention to my some of my co-investigators. This was a large collaboration, but I particularly wanted to call out Dr. Judy Mumford, who's retired from the EPA, Dr. Shah, who's a local physician in the Inner Mongolia area, and Dr. Gene Sanders, who's a cardiologist. I have no disclosures. I was going to briefly go over, fortunately Maria covered a lot of the background, that so I will go over that quickly. I'll describe some of the background about the situation in Inner Mongolia. I'll highlight the biomarkers I'm talking about today, which are one for a prolonged QT interval, which is a heart-related biomarker for a risk factor for arrhythmia and sudden death, and also for diabetes, and then a mortality and skin lesion analysis also. So I think a lot of this stuff is probably been covered already by Maria. Arsenic is naturally occurring and a product of a lot of industrial processes, but basically the exposure that affects millions of people worldwide is from waterborne exposures. And many places move to this exposure from a desire to obtain safe water from waterborne pathogens, and as a result, and unfortunately and tragically, result in having high arsenic levels. And as Maria indicated, it affects several countries and places worldwide, including parts of the U.S. So just a bit of a background. Arsenic has a long history of medicinal use. And one of the markers I'll be talking about today actually was noted as an effect of its use as an anti-cancer agent for leukemia in arsenic trioxide, but has been used in the treatment of syphilis. Obviously, lots of intentional poisonings. Napoleon was rumored to have been poisoned by arsenic. But early on, it has been linked to various cancers as a result of some of these treatments, as far back as the late 1800s. So the EPA, we do regulate arsenic at 10 parts per billion or 10 micrograms per liter. But there is a continued need to justify this level and to describe the effects at these low exposures. So here's some of this slide goes over some of the mechanisms by which arsenic can produce toxicity. It's both an acute poison and a chronic toxicant. I won't go into these in too much detail here, but there are many different mechanisms, and one reason for a lot of epi work is that there are actually few good animal models for a lot of these pathways. So these, again, I think this is we don't need to go into this, as this has already been covered. But one of the markers I'll be talking about today is related with diabetes, which I think is one of those outcomes where there's still some question about how well arsenic is associated, and there's been some recent kind of controversial or discrepant results in the literature. So this shows the Inner Mongolia area where we studied. It's an autonomous province in the bordering the of China, bordering Mongolia. And these are the arsenic-exposed regions in the Bamen area. And there's three provinces, Hanghe, Linghe, and Wuyan province are the arsenic-exposed areas that we studied. So this population has an average of 20 years of arsenic exposure, at least at the time we undertook our studies. It's a mostly farming, agricultural community. For elevated arsenic was first noted in 1984, and also, similar to the Bangladesh situation, was first noted through dermal effects, the hyperkeratosis and skin lesions in 1990. an advantage of studying this population is that they do own their own wells. Most wells are located on a household compound for individual exposure assessment. Because it's a kind of a rich farming community, they have comparatively good nutritional status. And as a result, this was an area where Dr. Mumford and others started to investigate some health studies in the late 1990s. They also made the public health areas, public health community and researchers maintain a database of arsenic levels in the area, which Dr. Mumford had access to, and they also have some existing medical records. Here's some snapshots of the farming compounds and the wells that the houses use for drinking and other uses. I just wanted to also call out our call attention to our key collaborators from Inner Mongolia. We worked collaboratively with the public health agencies, the Inner Mongolia Center for Endemic Disease Control and Research in Huhut, and that's Dr. Shah's group there, and many people, other people. Also the local anti-epidemic stations, they call them, which are kind of like public health outreach stations in all of the areas where we did research, and also their local centers for disease control. And these collaborations were all initiated and led by Judy Mumford, who's now retired from EPA. And ultimately, she set up a cooperative agreement between EPA and the Inner Mongolia Center for Endemic Disease Control. So the first series I'm going to talk about are studies that that Judy led, and these were she's a toxicologist, so she was looking at biomarkers and kind of a cross-sectional design, at least. And I call it cross-sectional because we collected water samples concurrently with the nail, blood, urine, EKG, and also survey information in the region. These were done at two different times in 2000 and 2003, and a range of exposures was targeted to capture some low exposed areas and some highly exposed wells based on our existing well water information that we had provided to us by our collaborators. We measured arsenic in nail, urine, and water, and in a variety of biomarkers from the blood samples and also saliva samples were collected, but today I'm just going to focus on a subset. Many of that's already been published, and I can refer anyone who's interested to the literature that Judy and others have published on it. But the total number enrolled for these studies was 941, but different groups were subset out for different studies, but the total enrolled for these were 941. So the first marker I was going to talk about was this QT interval. The QT interval is shown here. It's the time between the Q wave and the T wave in the EKG, and it marks the period of ventricular depolarization and repolarization, and prolonged QT intervals are associated with arrhythmia and mortality risk. As I mentioned, it's known that arsenic can cause a prolonged QT interval from the arsenic trioxide results from the cancer treatments. And how does it do this? Again, it's not really known, but one of arsenic's effects is interfering and affecting gene expression, could affect some potassium ion channel gene expressions, which could regulate this depolarization. So for our QT subset, 784 subjects had EKGs with the QT interval measured. We only included age 18 and over, although for this analysis, although the results didn't really make a difference, but there were not many under 18. The reasoning was under 18 with an abnormal QT may mean other heart issues that we weren't necessarily interested in. So corrected QTC, corrected for heart rate, was measured and categorized by two independent cardiologists. We accounted for a group of covariates that we could, a fairly wide range of things that may be associated with heart conditions, as well as demographic features related to, possibly related to arsenic exposures. In this group, there was a wide range of arsenic exposures, which was actually the goal, from below detection to 826 parts per billion, and with an average of about 14 years of exposure, and fairly wide ranges for nail and total urine arsenic as well. In terms of the abnormal QTC, which was defined as greater than 450 milliseconds, we saw 20% overall, and more in females than males. I think this is fairly common to see women have a longer QT interval. But basically, the 20% is higher than you would expect. In the U.S., it's about 8%. So we modeled this risk of abnormal QTC of 450 using logistic regression models, and basically found associations with all arsenic exposures, nail, water, urine, and we see, so for a standard deviation increase in well, there's a 44 odds ratio of 1.44, in a different kind of scale, for a 25 part per billion increase, 5% increase in odds, similar associations with nail and urine. So for the QTC, we used some nonlinear models, trying to identify thresholds, looking at like a fractional polynomial models, spline models, trying to identify a threshold point. We didn't see any obvious nonlinearity. Of course, there may be some question about the power of those models, but nonetheless, we modeled as a linear effect, and as a result, we also maybe confidently estimated the excess cases as well. So, and you can do this as assuming a population exposed to 50 parts per billion, we would predict, based on our model, 456 cases of abnormal QTC in men, and over 1,500 in women. And the 50 parts per billion we chose because actually that's a range where there are exposures in the U.S. In some wells. Of course, they're probably not exposed to the level of intensity and duration. But second marker I was going to discuss today was the diabetes marker, glycated hemoglobin, HbA1c, and arsenic. Also could be associated with diabetes risk through inducing insulin resistance, basically. Other pathways probably too, but the HbA1c marker is a measure of the percent glycated hemoglobin in red blood cells. And an advantage of this measure is that it doesn't require fasting, and it represents an averaged blood glucose over the past 3 months. And basically, there's different classifications, but greater than 6% has been shown to be at significant risk for subsequent diabetes. It's an established marker. It's now actually recommended as a test for diabetes risk by American Diabetes Association, the World Health Organization, It's been noted that diabetes has been associated with arsenic at higher levels in other populations. But as I mentioned, there have been some recent controversial and inconsistent results. Not all studies have seen associations with diabetes. A recent analysis from NHANES was controversial and kind of inconclusive in whether there was a relationship with the diabetes risk in urine in NHANES. So we did not enroll any... There were no known diabetics enrolled, and no one was on insulin. No one reported being diabetic. No one reported having a doctor's diagnosis of being diabetic. We had 590 who had their blood tested for HbA1c using the finger prick blood test. And basically, as you might expect in a non-diabetic population, there wasn't that many elevated HbA1c's, but we did see some in this high normal range, 5.6 to 6, which actually is a risk factor for subsequent diabetes as well. And the HbA1c levels were associated with age, occupation, BMI. But looking at our basically, if you consider HbA1c as a continuous measure, or if you categorize it any way you do it, there is associations with all the different types of arsenic exposures. We measured water, nail, and urine. a modest association, log increase in arsenic associated with a 0.1% increase in HbA1c. But if we use a slightly different model where we actually use the categories, normal, medium, and high of the HbA1c, this is a proportional odds model, which models the odds of being in a higher category. And it does make some assumptions of proportional odds across categories, but that it met all those, all the models met those assumptions. Basically, we can look at it a little bit in more detail, and then breaking out the arsenic categories into quintiles. I think these are quintiles. I said quartile, but these are quintiles. And basically, we did see a linear relationship also, but for this quintile analysis, we noted that for well water, we actually, you don't see a significant elevation until about the fourth quintile there for well water, which was about 82 parts per billion, which is not super high in terms of arsenic exposure. So again, we calculated feeling confident in our results, calculated the excess risks, and because it's maybe a meaningful way to describe the results. But basically, if our models and everything are somewhat correct, we would expect about 40 per thousand cases of elevated HbA1c, possibly attributable to arsenic, in this 82 to 181 range. So on to my last. Am I doing for time? Okay, I'm okay. Okay. For the last couple of health outcomes we looked at were in a slightly different study was mortality and skin lesions. To look at this, we did a complete census of a single village, Sahai Village, which had a range of arsenic exposures. We went and interviewed every household. We collected demographic information, well water arsenic measures, residence history. We obviously measured arsenic from each well or water source, and some were actually on community water, but most were on those handheld wells I showed. And we enrolled 3,284 households, and which representing 12,334 individuals. And very similar to Maria's approach that she described, we cataloged and identified deaths using an expert panel collecting medical records, actually in a very similar approach, and classified them according to ICD-9. So we, for the mortality analysis, we created a retrospective cohort where we determined, because we got information on people moving out, people moving in, so we could at least approximate it, and we determined person time and deaths, and deaths occurring between 1997 and 2004, and between this time period, we identified 572 deaths and 78,000 or so person years. We calculated the total age-adjusted mortality rate, which was reasonable, a little better than all the rest of China, but higher than the U.S., which seems right. In the analysis, we stratified, we stratified by years exposed to their current well, because we didn't have information on future wells, and this might help with having a bit better exposure measure if you've been exposed to the same well since 1990 or 1985. But again, we did see associations with total mortality, heart disease mortality, and broadly defined cancer mortality. We didn't really have enough cases to say what type of cancer mortality, and that's a pretty crude result. But we did not see an association with stroke, which was the other group we used. This shows the results, and I'm sorry, they're probably hard to read. But basically, in terms of quintiles of arsenic, those probably aren't quintiles. I think those are kind of groupings. But nonetheless, we didn't see a real elevated risk, and these are for people exposed since 1990, a real elevated mortality until you get quite high, over 300. But if you look at arsenic as a continuous measure, actually there is a trend for heart disease cancer mortality. And this is, and one interesting thing was it actually improves as you go back in the years you're exposed to your well. So for people exposed since 1985, their all-cause mortality association with arsenic is a little better than for 1990, which you might expect from better exposure classification and also longer exposure to the arsenic contaminated well. But also heart disease mortality, we see a relationship with even for people exposed since 1995. So last marker I was going to discuss was skin lesions, and here's some pictures of the hyperkeratosis and hyperpigmentations that are common from a chronic arsenic and linked to chronic arsenic exposures. But basically, during our census of the village, the public health surveyors and the nurses actually examined everyone they could. They couldn't examine everyone; not everybody was there, but everyone they could for the presence of skin lesions. They're familiar with these lesions. They know how to diagnose them. And if they weren't there, they had them report whether they knew if they had the skin lesions. Most people in the area are familiar with what the lesions are. So we saw some association between the prevalence of skin lesions in female gender, not a huge difference, age, drinking, farm work. These may be just demographic markers of different kinds of population correlates. But, you know, as we would expect, it's a very strong relationship with the well water arsenic measure. Kind of a tapering off there from at the 100, but these are actually just unadjusted estimates here. So if we 2% in the 0 to 5 well, and then a doubling just for 6 to 10, and then an increase, a bigger increase there for the 21 to 50, and then the over 50. But basically, if we again do some adjustment for covariates, it doesn't really affect the results much. And again, I know this is hard to read, but if we just look at all subjects, there's actually an increased risk of skin lesions, even for people exposed to 5 to 10. We were skeptical of that result. So again, because people may be moving from highly contaminated wells to lower wells, and that could bias this this result that we're seeing. So if you conservatively look at residents exposed since 1985, there's actually elevated risks still, even in the very low exposure range from 10 to 20. Even among people just using hand pump wells, because they may have had a different exposure classification. But to sum up here, we've been able to look at this population at a range of arsenic exposure for several different health effects, and this population represents, they have good nutrition. The single family wells allowed us to have good exposure assessment. We saw associations with biomarkers for heart disease and diabetes. The QTC, we haven't finished the analysis like with the QTC, is there a threshold? But we did see an elevated risk for this diabetes marker at 82 parts per billion. Skin lesions observed as low as 20 parts per billion. So I think we've been able to look and also see some health effects at these low to moderate exposure ranges. The area is in the process of replacing and remediating these wells, and they've used our data to identify those most highly exposed to go back and target the areas where they most need to replace them. So actually we have some post data to show that actually the overall exposures in the area are getting lower. So as I mentioned, there's many other papers that have looked at DNA repair gene activity, some other biomarkers related to telomere length and telomere activity, but these are all another toxicologist reported two papers on peripheral neuropathies in the area, and those are also published. And I want to thank a wide range of investigators and collaborators from the EPA and elsewhere that have helped with this research. And that's it. Thanks.
Average 20 years of exposure.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Right. Well, I was very similar situation to what's happened. There was a desire to get water that was free from, you know, probably microbial contaminants, and they moved to deeper wells. Yeah, almost very similar to what you see in other places. I mean, I don't think it was a you know, it wasn't like there was some kind of initiative from some public health agency, but they just did it, and kind of as it in the area, and unfortunately, they didn't know that there was arsenic in those deeper levels. But we do see relationships with depth, with the wells. I think there is a range where there's high arsenic. I think if you go really deep, you're not in this arsenic, but it's pretty variable, and I don't think they've got a great handle on it. Yeah. Yes. I think this is what the cardiologist told me, is that this is just he would have expected it, that women have a longer QT interval, and it's not so it's not it, and it and but it, there what it wasn't like there was an interaction with arsenic, and in fact actually the slopes are same, but they're just kind of starting off at a different baseline. So I mean, I went back and forth with him a little bit, like, does it make sense to have them both be 450 as the cut point for risk, but maybe that just automatically puts women at a higher risk for this particular kind of heart risk factor, you know.
I was just wondering, is there any point where if you stop arsenic exposure that your risk comes back down to normal, or do you continue to be at risk for these cancers?
I don't know for sure. I know for skin lesions, skin lesions will go away. After, you know, I mean, maybe not after, but I don't know, maybe other people know. I don't know I mean, I've seen studies that have shown that, you know, once in a population, once a arsenic is removed, like, cardiovascular deaths go down. But I don't know within like a person, I don't know. I don't know, maybe. Yeah. Well, right, and for bladder cancer, yeah, some of the more recent stuff, which was one of the original cancers that was noted. Now sometimes they say 30 years is what it takes or something, you know, to actually develop it. So that's one reason in looking at cancer, you know, you were able to go into this population and do surveys, you know, get some kind of cancer surveillance system together, maybe we could see cancers resulting from exposures in the 1990s.
I would also add that it may, if you have developmental exposure during the development,
yes,
period,
this is new.
It may be much harder to get back to not seeing that than if the exposures are only in the adult period.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw that in almost 2% of skin lesions, even 0 to 5 micrograms per liter. And,
yeah.
You know, even if they're drinking water at the neighbor's well, I'm wondering, do you see any other health effects that below 10 micrograms per liter?
That's a good point, and probably leads to some of the concerns about the data that we had, that people are probably moving from more highly exposed to lower exposed, but you know, there was nothing that jumped out as being obvious, you know, as, you know, about that group or an exposure at that level, that other health effects that I noticed. Yeah. Yeah, we saw similar, maybe not quite as good with 0.65, but there is an issue if you're using total urine or which, you know, we just use the total urine as well. But we also measured all the different, the inorganic component and organic component. We really saw very similar health effects for all of those, which actually just kind of increased our confidence in our overall result. And we saw good relationships with well water and urine, maybe not quite a 65% correlation. Also with nail, we saw good.
Do you or the speaker know whether that correlation varies with age or gender?
Well, this is a big area, I think, people who are studying the metabolism of arsenic, and because there is some evidence that, you know, the way arsenic is metabolized actually increases your, some of the metabolites, the dimethylated arsenic groups.
So that's where I was going.
Yeah.
If you see a fairly well-conserved correlation,
yeah,
then what does that tell you about the distribution of metabolomics
right
in the population?
Right.
At different populations. And if you don't see that much variability, does that give you any greater confidence that you're not missing something?
Yeah, I think,
otherwise?
I don't know. It's a great question. And I think it's, hope we're not really working on it, but I hope people are, because I think it's a good question. We have some data that could inform that. I think other people do too. So, yeah.
Are most of these people Mongolians?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Actually, they're almost mostly all there are Mongolians, but the vast majority are Han, and they actually maybe 5% Mongolian, but it's mostly Han, and they.
Just that the skin lesion thing, I think, is an interesting finding.
Yeah.
And you present prevalence. I was just wondering if you saw a difference in severity across those zones.
We did not for the census survey where we interviewed so many people, we did not get a gradient of severity. For some of the other biomarkers, we did. So. We could probably look at that because we did get a grading of severity, but not for the data I showed. Yeah. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.